We lost Renew. So, last time we kind of went over kind of some practical issues with system call filtering. You know, kind of that there's just too many of them for any cases of like, it's not actually so trivial to like take a program and just set up a filter to restrict what it does. Also, we had this issue that restricting things like file system accesses, which, you know, pretty logical thing to want to do. Well, there's lots of ways of specifying the names of a file, and also, like, the setconf API didn't let us actually read the file names out. So we're going to need some other idea there, with some other mechanism, which is what we'll talk about today, sort of a different style of mechanism than our system call filtering, and also then kind of our classical, like, chmod-type permissions. We also talked about kind of this application design idea of what I call privilege separation, where we say, I have an application that's doing some things I think are going to have security flaws. Like we're rendering a web page where we're processing JavaScript and HTML and CSS that comes from who knows where. You know, that sort of thing. We want to kind of run those sensitive tasks in an environment where, you know, if there's some sort of security flaw there, its impact is limited. And this is kind of a pattern we can imagine applying across applications. And it's been kind of most successful in the browser space, but I think there's a lot of applications where you can look at the application and say, you know, maybe there's some kind of place where we can take this part of the application I'm really concerned about the security of, move it somewhere where, you know, it runs with restricted permissions such that, you know, I can worry a lot less. And we just started on kind of something topic which we are first big topic for today, which is about thinking about changing what a program can name. So far we've talked about isolating a program or part of a program. We have this strategy of either system call filtering or running the program as a different user. And we're going to talk about kind of a different philosophy for isolating what a program can do. And this is a philosophy that's, you know, something that will let us make sort of better sandboxes and also enables things you might know of containers. So questions about things we covered last time. Okay, so some notes on the fuzz assignment from things that I saw in office hours. If the fuzz program stops without you terminating it, that probably means it got killed by a memory limit. It does not normally just stop. The way people just run this until they've decided they don't care anymore. But AFL by default just keeps going. If it runs slow, and the way you'll tell is that AFL's status screen shows you how many tests are running per unit time, and it puts that in red when it thinks maybe you should be making this run faster. If that's happening, that probably means it will take a lot longer for you to get a useful result. And what I recommend is make the base inputs simpler, and I mean really simple. If you think about what we want our kind of end result to be, what we'd like to have is a bug report that says, here's, you know, the simplest way of reproducing this bug. And so, you know, we want the length of what we hope to find is actually probably pretty short. And so I would suggest, you know, that you should try to target that your base cases are that short. And this also should mean that, you know, that testing all the variations will be faster. If we have a very long test case, it's likely to be the case that, you know, we can run like maybe, you know, a tenth of those that we can as a short test case. So we'll just get a lot less done and the fuzzing will go a lot slower. If you're saying, well, but the problem is that if I make this test case really short, there isn't like the interesting thing for the indent program to do. That's a good concern. And my suggested solution is that we can have kind of multiple base cases. So just say, well, if I wasn't testing like another function, like make another test case or test another function. That sort of thing. So questions about fuzzing assignment? Okay. And I'll take assignment Q&A, and I guess I will note sort of the next assignment, which I need to mark is not, double check and mark is not tentative, is, I think it's basically ready, is sort of the next assignment is a sandboxing assignment where we're going to use libsetconf, most likely, and set up a system call filter. And I've given you a library so we can do the privilege separation pattern. So we're going to have some library that you aren't allowed to change that has a Stack Overflow and also tries to create files when it shouldn't. And your goal is to make it so we can still use that unchanged library without risking that these things sort of cause, any danger besides the output we get from that library being bogus. And because, and I've given you an IPC library for that, which if you've taken CSO2, you might know how to write, it uses pipes, but the idea is you can just use that, because this is not a class about how to use the POSIX APIs for communicating with another process. And that's kind of a prerequisite, right, because we set up a filter for the process. I want to make sure that works. Okay, so let's get to our main topic for starting with. Mentioned last time that kind of the way setconf works and the way permissions work, where you run as a different user, is that a program tries to access something and the system checks if that's okay. There's kind of a completely different model for managing program access, where instead we change what resources a program can name. And the idea is that we make it so the program can't actually name the resources we don't want it to access. And we'll give some specific examples of this in a bit. And this idea where we check what a program can access, this idea is sometimes called by people who are usually criticizing it, ambient authority. That kind of in the air, ambient to the program, is its ability to access things that's tied to the running program, but it's not explicit in the program's request for resources. There's this alternate model called capabilities, where we have a list of things the program is allowed to access. And we can kind of think of that's the same way of saying, if the program can name it, it can access it, right? So we have a list of things the program can access, and that list of things it can access serves both as the way of accessing things and the permissions check in this model. And you actually see this in sort of some resources. So open files are basically following this model. The list of files that are already open you can access is the ones you've opened. If you don't have a file handle, you can't just access a file. And there's some OSs which has kind of extended this design to kind of apply the same philosophy to other resources. So, for example, we might say that when you want to do something to another process, you need to get a process handle to that process. And like a file handle, if you have a process handle, you can manipulate the process. If you don't, you can't. And like a file handle, maybe you open the process for killing, or maybe you don't. And just like you can open a file for writing or not for writing. And the same notions would apply. And we could imagine applying this to ports on the network, directories, and so on. And to make this useful, what we have to deal with, a big reason why we have access control lists is because I just get a file name, and that's what I use to like transfer, you know, information between programs, is I supply both of them with the same file name. In this capability-based system, you know, we can't quite do that. So we need some way of kind of transferring something from one program to another that's not just transferring the name. So we'll typically have a way of directly transferring the capability from one program to another. So rather than telling a program the PID, you somehow give the program your process handle. And system operating systems that are based on capabilities will do this. We'll have a mechanism to do this, I should say. And you might say, doesn't this seem unusable? And, well, depends what you're doing. Often, probably the most prominent examples of this OS design are for embedded systems, where the usability problems don't come up because we're not like running a command line. But people have built kind of a normal-looking Unix command line on top of this, and how you. So the question is like, but how do we make like opening a file by name work? And often the way you do that is you have a system service, like a server you contact and give the file name to, and it gives you back a handle if you're allowed to access it. And so in this way, we still are doing the ambient authority thing, but we're doing it outside the core of the OS. This is attractive if we're thinking about, I want to make sure the OS is written correctly. Well, it's easier to check if the OS is not doing. If the access control checks are not in the core of the OS, you can look elsewhere and check those independently. So that's an aside. But let's look at kind of a more practical thing we can actually do in our systems, and this has to do with naming and mounting. So on Unix systems, when we sort of set up a file system, we can sort of mount them at a kind of arbitrary location in sort of directories. So for example, on my Linux desktop, when I wrote this slide, I had two devices, and one of them appeared as slash, as the root directory, and one of them appeared as a directory inside that. And this was something I could configure. And we call this kind of subdirectory a mount point. And kind of in this way, there's not something like really special about like a directory that's a mount point versus not. And what I can access is just based on kind of where what's in my slash and what things are mounted underneath it. Right. And Unix implements this idea where, well, you'd think by me saying, oh, like I have slash as my SSD, that means that there's some global notion that that is the root, you know, the root directory is this. But Unix actually tracks this for each process. So each process has a directory it points to that is its root. So the idea here is that I can choose a part of my directory tree and make that be the all of the directory tree for a file with this chroot call. And sort of a classical example is that a way people have written, so for example, a file transfer server is that the server gets chrooted into the files it's supposed to access, and it, you know, after that point, when it tries to open a file, it just can't name anything outside the root that it's chrooted to. So as an example, I'm running these commands as root here. I make a directory, temp example, and I copy bin ls to it. Then I try to run ls from there. And that's quoted. And what this chroot utility does is it calls chroot slash temp slash example, which changes the current process's root directory to what was previously temp example. So now anytime I access any file name, it's always based on temp example. It also then chdirs to slash which is now Tempered Temple. And then it runs / LS. And in this case, when it runs / LS, it gets no such file or directory. And well, the reason why is that LS is a dynamically linked executable, and it can't even open the things it needs to run. It needs the C library and all that. That's not there. It can't run. So what I can do is I can set up my chroot to have the files it needs to run. Yeah, so I first start by saying, okay, it needs some stuff in lib64. Let's copy all of that stuff. It needs some stuff in libxx64 Linux GNU. Let's copy all of that stuff. And then it gets closer to running, but I've missed a file here, so let's copy that file, and then I can run it. And when I run it, well, if I ask to look at / I see I have the files I copied. It's looking at temp example. And if I ask to look at the parent directory of / there's a rule that the / is always the root of the hierarchy. If you ask for its parent directory, you just get the same directory. Some questions here. So this lets us isolate a process. It seems a little inconvenient for like providing everything the process needs to run. We can make that a little less bad by starting a process and having it chroot in the middle. The challenge with this is that you can only call chroot if you're root. So the process would have to be running as root. And I'd say I have to copy all these files. That sort of seems inconvenient. And we're going to go back to our idea that we can like mount other file systems in the middle of a directory. So on Linux, we have a better solution for this, which is that we can do bind mounts. So we can, rather than saying, I want this disk to appear in this directory, I can say, I want this other file system that's on a different disk, some part of it to appear in this directory. We can do that. We can request that with this idea of a bind mount. It uses the same mechanism as, you know, make this disk appear here, except we're not specifying a whole disk, we're just specifying part of another disk that's loaded elsewhere. So I see it's root for isolating things. Yeah?
So if you use like the bind mount to bring library instead of programming into a directory, could you mount those as like read-only and that way?
Question is, can I do the bind mount as read-only? Yes. That is supported. And would be important here. Okay. Now, it seems like a limitation of this chroot idea is that we can't get at anything outside that root, and that seems like that might not be super useful. This bind mount maybe gives us a way of getting controlled access outside. But there's other ways of getting things outside the root. So one thing is that if we have a file that's open to something outside the root, it's still open. So for example here, I'm running / ls going to temp.txt. That doesn't have to be in temp example. It will still write there. It's fine. It's already opened. And we don't care about already open files if they're located somewhere that we can't name. The other way we can access things outside the root is that we can have a file open, a directory open. So on Linux, directories you can open with open. So here I'm using opath. This would also work with odirectory. And I can open a file, a directory, and get a file descriptor for it. And I can use that file descriptor to open other things. This is probably disappointing from the perspective of making chroot effective, though, because dot dot works just as it should in there. And in this example, right? I'm opening temp other, which should be outside the ch root that I set for temp example. So I ch root the temp example, I change directory to there to make sure I'm not outside of the files I should be in. But the problem is that this handle to temp other not only lets me access things in that directory, so this is temp other other.txt, it lets me access things in its parent directory. So maybe a bit of a concern. So this is like, this case, this was helpful. This is not helpful because now this sort of having any directory open outside the root now lets us sort of ignore the ch root, which, you know, is not going to be good if we're thinking of isolating dangerous programs with this. The other issue with ch root is that if you're root, you still have the normal access the system administrator does to devices. So you can, for example, access a disk, like directly. The usual solution to this is that when we ch root, we combine that with changing to a user who doesn't have access to devices like disks. Some questions? So ch root, you know, is well known because it was implemented a long time ago. You know, it's like from the 70s. And so it's like when people wanted to do sandboxing, it was like used to be the only game in town. And it does like do a lot of things that are really useful. It's also useful for kind of non-security things, like if you want to run a different OS on your OS, this is a way of doing that. But, you know, it's not super practical to set up for a typical program. Like, it's really, you know, making a web browser that uses chroot requires a bunch of kind of weird configuration to install. Like, we need extra copies of all the files that are outside the root or some other way of getting them there. If we have multiple chroots and we want to have those programs communicate, that seems tricky to set up, right? Because they don't share any files. Especially if we don't have bind mounts, we have bind mounts, we can solve that. And maybe one of the bigger things is that it requires administrator permissions to configure, and this is a deliberate choice. You might say, why don't you just let anyone call chroot? A big problem with that is that utilities like sudo might get very confused if we run them in a chroot. The most trivial thing is that sudo probably loads libc.so. And a trivial attack that we could do if we could chroot and then run sudo is that we could create a directory that has sudo in it and a libc.so that is malicious, and we run sudo and it loads our malicious libc.so. And we just have that libc.so, like, replace printf with a function that gives us a shell, and, you know, now we have root access. So because of that, you know, the history is that Unix traditionally doesn't allow chroot if you're on an administrator. We'll talk about kind of a fix Linux has for this, but we need to restrict some other permissions to make this plausible. So we talked about chroot. Let's do. So I mentioned this is an isolation technique. What things might make sense to use this for? Which of these? You discussed with your neighbors. we'd like some more time? Anyone have a proposal for something that is either most, makes the most sense or the least sense? So we're going to use CH root to hopefully make it more secure. We're probably more secure, I mean, that if it gets compromised, we are less concerned. Like, what scenario does this make more or less sense? Yeah. Okay, so sort of, so the idea is only specific file access. And chroot is a way of making that happen and making it happen even if someone compromises the web server. The best they can do is change the files the web server should have access to. They can't read or change other files on the system. Okay, other. So that's for most sense. Other proposals? Or what makes the least sense then? Seems most problematic. No opinions? Let's do, no one's showing it. So let's say, who thinks A makes the least sense? Okay. Who thinks C makes the least sense? D? Okay. So, someone want to defend any of those answers? Yeah. Okay. So you're saying it doesn't need files? Okay. So I would say that's a reason it makes more sense, because chroot is kind of a way of doubling down on it shouldn't access files. Like, if we didn't have a system call filter, a chroot would prevent that, or if our system call filter is broken, the chroot will mitigate that. And as an example, I talked about privilege separation in OpenSSH. Chroot was because they were implementing that before system call filtering was common, they used chroot as their primary sandboxing mechanism. And they just chrooted the privilege separated thing to an empty directory. So the question is, how does it talk to the rest of the browser? So, yeah, that's a good question. Like, does that really practical if it's running in the, if it can't open any files? And I would say, like, it's probably a lot harder to set that up, right? Because usually with chroot, we need administrator permissions to set it up, and that seems logistically difficult to set up, that we have some utility with administrator privileges that runs this, and yet it runs in a way where it can communicate with the rest of the browser. I think it's possible to do, but it is indeed a bunch more work than these other scenarios where it's simpler to figure out how to do that because we don't need to set up this communication. Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
Because I think you would have like a connection, you accept the connection, you tell the thing that's connecting what the time it is, and then that's like pretty much it.
Okay. Yeah, so I'd say network time server doesn't need files or communication sort of with anything else. So I would agree. My assessment is the network time server is like the easiest case because we don't even need to think about what's in the chroot. But I understand the argument for the web server, because the web server, the chroot is giving us the most benefit. Because a web server is doing things that I am the most concerned will access files it's not supposed to. And so in that sense, I see a very good argument for the web server, because like, you know, the for the web server, this prevents us from the classic bug of open, you know, path plus input, where input contains, you know, ... in some way we haven't checked for properly, which has is a big problem that web servers have had. Yeah. So my opinion would be either B or D to kind of would make the most sense. B, because it's relatively straightforward what to do, and it, you know, it seems the most case where the file system access is the most risky. And also we can't use the alternative of just filtering out all open calls. Right, that clearly is not an option for a web server. Other opinions? Okay, so what I thought made the least sense is the media player, because what file are we playing? And how does it read that file? That file is probably not in a convenient separate directory from other files we don't want it to access, unless we do some extra work. We could probably make it happen, but it seems tricky to make that, just run it in a ch root, because we need to be able to open kind of files in quote-unquote dangerous directories that we don't sort of know in advance when we set up the program. Okay, so that's some thoughts on ch root. Yeah, and I guess, so, I'm glad I brought this up, because something that's not obvious is that, like, people often, you know, when they can, use ch root just to make it so something can't access any files. Even though, yes, we know kind of a quote-unquote better way of doing that with system call filtering. You know, people do this when they don't have the system call filter, or if they don't want to have to trust the system call filter. So, chroot, like, it works where we have each program has its own idea of what the root directory is, and we can apply this idea to other system resources. And Linux has a feature which applies this to other resources called namespaces, where basically we have different sets of names, and when the OS needs to look up the name of something, it checks the current namespace to do that lookup. And this namespaces mechanism is kind of the basis of container-based isolation on Linux these days. Maybe not historically, but nowadays this is primarily how containers are implemented. And one type of namespace that current Linux supports is, as an example, is user namespaces, where rather than having global user IDs, each program has a notion of what user IDs are, and there's a mapping in every program, and whenever you make a system call and give it a user ID, it looks up uses that mapping to look up the real version of that user ID before doing any checks. And so this means that you can run a program where the program thinks it's root, but all the system calls say root is really some other user. And if you're in this namespace, it's really hard to actually do anything not as root. Because when you try, the system says, no, you're not root. And we can also apply this idea to sort of like list of what the current list of devices are, or what network devices there are, to restrict network access, which we haven't had a good way of kind of limiting it. This gives us a way of doing that, where we say, when you look up what are the network devices, the list you get depends on what namespace you're in. And if you aren't kind of in the default namespace, you could be in a namespace which has fewer network devices available than are actually attached to the system. And as for like how this works from an API point of view, so on Linux, so if you took CSO2, you learned about this fork system call. And it's not actually typically how we make new processes on Linux. In Linux, there's a clone system call that starts a new processor thread, and as the name suggests, it does it by default by copying the current processor thread. And it takes a whole bunch of flags, and among the flags, we can say we want a new namespace of a certain type. So if I want to have a new process run where it has a different notion of what user IDs mean, we can specify that when we're creating a new thread or process. Alternately, there's this call called unshare, which changes the current process's namespace. It says, I want to make a new namespace for users. I want my current process to have a different notion of what users are than the other, and after we make this call, we'll configure that namespace. And in the case of user namespaces, you can basically say, I want to map user ID 0 to 1000, user ID 1 to 1001. You can specify those operations. And you might say, well, why doesn't this let me map anything to 0? You know, so you can only specify mapping to arbitrary user IDs if you're root. And if you're not root, you can only specify mapping to your current user ID. And if you have nested namespaces, the mappings are applied recursively, so you end up being restricted by kind of the outermost link. So user namespaces seem like kind of a cool trick that we can convince a program it's running as root when it's not really running as root. And this is great for containers where we want to run programs that, we want to run programs consistently without giving them full privileges, but it doesn't really solve any real security problems. We could just not run the program as root, normally. So where things get interesting is that Linux has mount namespaces, that we can have a different notion of what file systems are mounted for each process. This is kind of like an extension of chroot, but rather than choosing a different root directory, we don't just choose a different root directory, we just choose a different list of files, list of directories that are actually mounted, and we can have some of these be bind mounts to the outside files when we're setting up this mount namespace. So as an example, I can make my run a shell, binsh, in a new mount namespace, and then I can create some directories and make bind mounts in this temp workdir directory to everything else I want to use from the main file system, and then I run chroot in this new set, and these aren't mounted in the parent file system. They only exist for processes in this mount namespace, so I'm not like setting up. And you might say, well, it's nice that we made these bind mounts only work in this for some processes, but why is that useful? And the reason it's useful is that Linux lets you combine this with user namespaces as a special case, because a problem we had previously is that normally you're not allowed to do these operations of mounting new file systems or chrooting if you are on root. So that's a real problem, because this means that we could have this functionality, but now to set it up, we have to have a system administrator privileges. And if we want to use this to like isolate our renderer in the browser, that's really annoying if our browser has to run something as system administrator to run. But Linux lets you use these together where you make a new user namespace and you make sure that everything maps to only a regular user, including root. And the idea is that this makes it so anything running in that user namespace can't really run as root anymore. There's no way for it to ever obtain root access ever again, including programs like sudo. Sudo will work. It will say, I'm running as root, I think. But when it actually tries to do something, the system will be using the user namespace, not give it root permissions. So we have this sort of fake system where every user is not, we have all the user IDs, but they're all really like my user ID. So programs that think they're running as root, really running as me. If you set this up as a special case, Linux lets you use bind mounts and chroot, because we know now they're safe to use. The reason we don't allow chroot is because I could like fool sudo into running dangerous code as root. Well, now I can't do that because I'm in a user namespace. And there's a similar reason why you can't just bind mount as a normal user. Typically, now that's not a concern because I can't affect other users. It's only things in this process, namespace. And so this is a way, this is kind of the modern way of implementing something like Docker. If you ever use Docker or similar, like half the class. So tools like Docker, which basically kind of run a virtual Linux system in a Linux system, this is the sort of modern mechanism for supporting that and making that secure. And you can see that this also kind of doubles as a nice sandboxing mechanism. We can run a program with only access to specific files. We can choose those files. And we can set this up without being the system administrator. And I mentioned we have namespaces, which kind of can work similarly for other resources. Probably the most interesting here is for the network. So we can set up a virtual network device and have some processes when they try to figure out what are the available network devices, they only find that one. So when they try to figure out what's my available IP addresses, it's only that one's. And this is a way we can finally, like without system call filtering, constructively limit what network things a program can access, by sort of configuring a virtual device and limiting what that device can access. Or maybe if you don't want the program to have any network access, we could do this with system call filtering, but we can also just do it by saying the only network device you have access to is the one that accesses localhost only. That's it. There's also, tied into this namespace mechanism, you can have a separate host name. So the notion of the host name is not global, it's actually per process. You can have separate process identifiers. So this means that I can run a program such that it literally cannot kill a program outside of its process namespace, because it can't name it. When it tries to use a process ID, it gets mapped to the real process ID from this process namespace, similar to how our user IDs were mapped to the real one. And also, this is tied to control groups. So if you look at the fuzzing assignment, like we set these memory limits, control groups are tied to this namespace mechanism. So a process can be in a control group, which acts like these namespaces, and that those control groups can have a memory or CPU or disk IO limit set for them. And also device restrictions. And this is kind of what generic sandboxing programs you may see. So you mentioned Docker. There's a bunch of other component things in the same area. There's some lighter weight tools that, so I guess I would say Docker and LXC and Containerd, these programs, they basically kind of run a virtual system in a system. There are some tools which are lighter weight, like Bubble Wrap is one I've used for grading stuff, where it doesn't run off, it doesn't like make a whole system, it just makes it just sets up specific things you ask for and runs a program in this sort of constrained environment where we use namespaces to limit what files it can access, limit what processes it can access, and so on. And there's another side of things and slides I've cut where there's a completely separate security mechanism called SELinux, which implements access control list type stuff. And you can also use that for sandboxing, though I think it's a lot less elegant. But it's older. So questions? Containers. So containers is one application. This also, you know, is kind of the modern way that on Linux, Chrome's isolation works for its renderer processes. It uses both seccomp and container and these sort of namespace IDs together. And the same with Firefox. So on Linux, they are using both of those mechanisms to isolate things. And again, part of it is that if the seccomp filter is set wrong, these namespaces sort of really mitigate the damage you can have. And they also let you like filter file accesses in an intelligent way, which might be really hard with a seccomp filter. OK, so our last 3 minutes. We've talked about sandboxing. And one thing we should talk about is sandbox escapes. Because there's something people are concerned about, so I'm going to give some examples, but they're all kind of different. And we kind of saw an example of a sandbox escape with my chroot example here, right? Where we had just had an open handle to a directory lying around, and oops, sandbox is useless. And there have been bugs, you know, of a similar flavor in other things. And as an example, we'll talk about a bug in a program called RunC from 2019, where this was a bug in how they used the Linux namespace APIs to do things. And the idea here is that they would is the attack is that a user who could start a malicious container, and then that user runs a new command in that malicious container, the container basically could use them running the second command to take over the program that was running commands from outside the, take over the program outside the container. And part of why this was so bad is that at the time, Docker and similar programs weren't using user namespaces, because it turns out that user namespace support is very recent. And also, it's sometimes turned off because there's some security questions about whether changing user IDs can break other things. And so this meant that the program that starts a new command is running as root, and is only kept from doing dangerous things because it, you know, just only does what it's supposed to do, you hope. Now it doesn't get hijacked. Okay, so we'll talk about what this over, again, I don't have enough time to go over this now, so we'll sort of go over sort of what was going on here, but basically the story here is that there was some API we didn't account for where containers were working as documented, but allowed access we didn't expect. And we'll talk about what that is next time. And this is like one of the things we have to watch out for in sandboxing in general.